E-commerce startups are commonplace in Pakistan. However, a significant segment of the society sits on the sidelines because they seek bargains that they can't find online. My guest in this episode of the Misal Podcast wants to change that. His name is Heather Raza and he's a co-founder of DealCart, a social commerce startup bringing community and group buying to Pakistan's rapidly growing e-commerce market. Let's listen in. Welcome to the Misal Podcast, Heather. How are you?
I'm doing great, Zayed. Thank you for having me.
You are working in a very exciting social retail e-commerce landscape in Pakistan. And I think DealCart is very, you know, unique in that sense. Like, I don't think there is anyone else out there doing what you're doing. So would love to learn more about that. But before we get to that, let's get started with a quick introduction. Please tell me a little bit about yourself and what exactly is the problem that you're trying to solve with DealCart?
First, coming to the quick intro, I am born and raised here in Karachi. Spent all of my life here pretty much. Went for undergraduate studies to Lahore, to Lums for 4 years in the middle. And then basically post that have been working here. So started off in 2014 with PNG. So sometime in the supply chain function, sometime in marketing. Towards the end of that stint, I kind of realized that I wanted to be in startups, that I'm more of a builder, even though, I mean, PNG is a brilliant company, great place to work right up there. But I decided to quit and start my first company with my co-founders, who are also incidentally from the same university. And we started a travel and tourism marketplace to kind of match demand with supply, make that whole process more efficient, more easy for both customers and for the suppliers of tourism experiences. So that started out in 2016. Luckily, and you know, even in this environment, we were able to kind of exit the company early on last year to this company called Gozean that wanted to come in and start their own travel marketplace here. They're a Bangladesh-based company. So they acquired us in a cash and share swap kind of deal. So that was, you know, that was nice. And then post that, other than that, I've also been involved in Kareem. So one of the early people in Pakistan for that, launched bikes, some new categories, new cities. So all of the exciting stuff I was doing over there. Then post the Uber acquisition, I went to Swivel. Swivel, I was the first person to be hired over here in Pakistan. Launched the new cities and then became the GM for Karachi. Post that, went for my master's. And during my master's in the UK, is when I kind of had the time to really reflect and think about what I wanted to do next. And the you know, the overarching kind of desire that kept coming up was the fact that I wanted to come back to Pakistan and build another company, and this time around in a larger space, and once again along the same lines of making an impact here, and try to do something for the majority over here, you know. And yeah, so basically decided to move back in March of 2022, and got together with my co-founder Amar, and yeah, from there we just launched a pilot, and yeah, it's ever since, it's been like 15-16 months since we started. So yeah, it's been an incredible journey ever since. So that's like a short intro to myself and what I've been doing so far. And in terms of DealCart, right, and what is the problem that we're trying to address? So I think it's two pronged. Firstly, you've got in Pakistan, we've all heard of the stats multiple times that, you know, there's 100 million smartphone users, 3G, 4G users, and all of that, right? And even though these people are spending a tremendous amount of time on social media, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, what have you, they're using a lot of the internet, but they're not really transacting online. So e-commerce penetration is still quite lagging versus even other emerging and or developing economies. You know, even general comparisons to India, to Bangladesh, to some developed startup ecosystems in Africa, where we're quite behind when it comes to e-commerce penetration. So we got to kind of wondering, why that is and what are some of the models that are kind of more aligned or attuned to emerging markets that encourage people to come online and transact online. So we saw that a good way or what's missing or what's the problem or what's the gap here is essentially is that we believe or our hypothesis is that the current e-commerce companies are geared towards the higher income segments of Pakistan, let's say the top 2-3, roughly 4% of the country, where you've got quick commerce players that are basically focused on convenience, providing you what you need in 30 to 40 minutes or so, and that comes at a cost. So that convenience, of course, comes at a cost. There's delivery fees associated to it. There's other fees associated to it, and then of course the product cost itself is quite expensive. So if you look at these quick commerce applications, their assortments are very kind of geared towards a higher income segment. So we felt that first, that is not catering to, let's say, the meat of Pakistan, right? Let's say, and then you've got Daraz that has been for the longest time has been focused on electronics, high ticket electronics, high ticket fashion. Not really the stuff that the average Pakistani is really buying regularly through e-commerce. So for us, that's the very clear gap. Right. And we're building for middle Pakistan, where we're building for the middle and low middle income segments, where our entire value proposition is aligned to what they're actually looking for. This particular segment is actually looking for and something that they can use on a very regular basis. Then we looked at what is the thing that is the, let's say, the most standout pain point for this particular segment that no one is really building for. So first we identified the gap, and then we looked at, what do they really need? What are they looking for? And again, when we were kind of doing our research before we started the company, it was very, very obvious. And even if we just take a sense check, it's quite intuitive that these people are super price conscious and they're looking for the best deals, right? They want to save money. And in fact, over the past year and a half, the kind of inflation that we've been seeing, in fact, for longer than that, is something that everyone is basically looking to save some money right now. It's gotten, the prices have gotten ludicrous. So more and more these people, 50 to 60% of their income is being spent on groceries, and that just keeps on going up because of inflation, right? So everyone wants to save money. So we're essentially enabling people to save money on their daily groceries and essential items that they're already spending upwards of 60% of their income on. We're helping people save money on that. Now, how are we helping save money? How are we helping deliver that value proposition is as follows, very simply, is that we help people purchase in larger quantities via group buying. So you and I can get together and buy something in a larger quantity. And when we do that, we will both get a wholesale rate, roughly 10 to 15% off from the market rate or the market MRP. And that depends, of course, on the product. On some products, it's lower because the margin spread is lower. And on some products, it's actually higher because the margin spread is higher. So the unstructured supply chains have a higher margin spread. The structured supply chains have a lower margin spread. So that's one part of it, which is we get people to buy in groups in larger quantities. The next part of it, or the next leg of this business, or how we're delivering this value proposition of helping people save money, is our assortment strategy. So what you will see on DealCart and what is being sold is you will see a focus on tier 2, tier 3 and unbranded products. These are products that you will generally not find being sold on e-commerce, right? So these are your regional players or regional brands that, for example, we've got tons of oil and ghee brands that you probably have not heard of. And in fact, even before we started the company, even I had not heard of these brands because they don't have the kind of marketing and distribution muscle to really get people aware of them. But these are cheaper and our target audience really likes them. So we've got across all categories, we've got tier 2, tier 3 brands, and that really works for our customer. Our customer really wants these products and they're willing to try them because it becomes like a discovery platform for them as well. And the fact that we've got an assortment that is relevant to a target audience that where they want to save money. We don't have any of these imported luxury items or any of that stuff on our platform. That's simply not who we are. We're building for a different target audience. So yeah, that's the second thing. And the third thing which makes this business model happen is the operations and logistics of it. So we're not quick commerce. We're not interested to provide you the product within the next 30 minutes. That's not what we do. What we do is that we get you to buy in groups. And then once those groups are completed, we deliver the next day, which means that you have to wait for your product. It's not going to show up at your doorstep in 60 minutes or 30 minutes. And that again, once again, allows us to be quite lean when it comes to our operations costs. So we are completely based out of one warehouse in Karachi. We don't have 15, 16, 17 dark stores. And we've got our fleet is and the operations are aligned such that one delivery rider who works with us or a delivery van takes 30 to 40 orders with them on a daily basis and deliver them across. So our costs are quite optimized when it comes to that. So overall, I think based on these three legs, we are basically helping people save middle. We're helping middle Pakistan save money on groceries and their daily essentials. And so far, the customers are resonating quite well with this. And thankfully, they're pleased with our services. That's essentially the crux of what we're trying to do. And now we're actually moving beyond groceries and daily essentials as well. We're adding other non-grocery items that would be high frequency purchases. So they would still take a good share of wallet of our customers, but they're outside of the grocery space. So we just want to kind of evolve into a platform that is beyond grocery.
How did you discover your customer? Like, what was that process like when you were talking to your co-founder? Was there some insight that, you know, he brought in or maybe you brought in that made you go after a certain demographic?
I think there's a couple of things here. I think when I started my first company with my co-founders, a year into it or maybe less than that, I kind of did realize that you always want to be, or for the most part, if you're building in Pakistan, you want to build for scale. You want to build something that has the potential to become a very, very large company, both in terms of, you know, value and as well as volume. I think that was a key lesson that I learned from my previous entrepreneurial experience. And I think that is something that was super top of mind for me. So I wanted to build, both me and my co-founder, we wanted to build in a large, large space. So that was one. So the total addressable market was something that was super important to us. So grocery is probably right up there when it comes to the size of the market, right? That's every household's need across the country. So I think that was one. Two, I think, was the fact that we are, and through your previous podcasts, I'm sure you've come across other people, ex-Kareem people, but both me and Amar are ex-Kareem. So in our kind of mindset or our DNA, we have this thing where we want to kind of build something that helps people or is impactful, right? Something that people kind of resonate with, something that is meant for a lot of people in Pakistan that a lot of people can benefit from. So I think that was also top of mind for us. And we had seen how Pinduoduo in China, which is basically the pioneer of social commerce in the world, pretty much the kind of impact that it had made and how well it had done, both in terms of the millions and millions of customers that it serves, as well as the kind of, you know, growth and financial metrics it had. So we were quite inspired by the Pinduoduo story. Of course, it's not something that we can kind of replicate exact in Pakistan, because China is a very different market. But in terms of an inspiration for this model, I think Pinduoduo played a key role for us. Both me and Amar were kind of quite excited by building some version of a Pinduoduo in Pakistan. I think that was a very, very exciting thought. And then finally, I think the third thing was the kind of things that me and Amar could do well. So I had an FMCG background. Amar had a background of scaling and then making large businesses profitable through Kareem. He'd done so in Saudi, which was pretty much their biggest business, as the head of that market. So I think we kind of also thought about what are we great at, and what can we build where our skill sets and our insights as founders can actually help the company a lot. So I think around these three factors is why we decided on this particular model. When it comes to the selecting the pain point or the target customer, I think it was driven by these three factors, but then at the same time, it was also kind of seemed to be very intuitive to us, because he's grown up in Lahore, I've grown up in Karachi, and we had both grown up. If you're living here and if you're working or studying or whatever, you will know that this is a huge issue, right? And you will know that in the online space, no one is really catering to this particular need in the market. So I think it was based on some intuitive learning and understanding that we had, and then it was based on the three factors that I described.
When I first heard about DealCart, the only thing that I could think of was like Groupon. So we here in the US have Groupon, and Groupon is mostly for services. And I can't remember the last time I even used it. It was like a really long time ago. So, but they are also, of course, going after, you know, the price conscious market that goes after, like, you know, gets a deal for, I don't know, for a massage or some sort of a service, right? And I think that's where the idea comes from. That was like back like in 2010. So it's like almost 10, 15 years ago. But when I think about DealCart, like I see like, you know, how this would catch on with the consumers. But what was your journey like with the suppliers? Like when you went to a supplier, did you explain to them what you're doing? Or did you just say, hey, I'm cool, you know, we just need to buy products from you and, you know, that's it. Or did you explain to them what you do?
So I think initially, right, when you're very small, because we're in the retail space, right, we're very much a retail company. In that sense, when you're very small and you're buying in very, you know, little small insignificant quantities for them, they're not going to talk to you. Then they're not even going to you know, entertain you as a customer. So what happens is that initially we went to the likes of Jodia Bazaar, Metro, Imtiaz, and we bought our products from there, and then we sold them to our customers. And of course, the rates that we were getting were not great, because if you're buying from a Metro, you're already, you know, or an Imtiaz, you're already, there's two middlemen that are also taking their margins in the middle, and then you're not getting any bulk quantities either, bulk discounts either. So that's how we started, right? And at that time, just to prove that concept, we bought from there. We put some group discounts on it. We made a WhatsApp group and kind of started to advertise in that WhatsApp group against these great prices, and it kind of took off from there. And then eventually, as we rationalize prices, because obviously we can't sell the products at a loss. We don't do that. As we rationalized, as we improve, as we grew, and we started to deliver more and more volumes for these suppliers, then we started to get direct with them. And now about, I think, in fact, 95-96% of whatever we buy comes directly from manufacturers. But it wasn't always like that. It was zero when we started. And then over time, it's been a process to kind of directly work with all of them and then also get them to give us great rates. Yes, you definitely have to explain what you do for them. For, let's say, the likes of these large structured organizations, you are another e-commerce channel, another e-commerce platform. That they kind of treat as part of their e-commerce portfolio. And for unstructured suppliers, it's different. When I say unstructured, I mean these tier two, tier three brands where they are not very large companies. They are kind of medium-sized operations, decent large operations, but still like medium-sized, right? They are more informal. So over there, it's more about purely about the volumes that you're moving. It's less about your concept and what target audience you're serving. They are more interested in the fact ki yaar aap mere liye kya is mahine 50 ton ya 100 ton maal move karenge ya nahi karenge. And that's about it. That's a conversation, and you have to kind of build great relationships. And it's very relationship based. So those are the kind of, you know, two different supplier types that we have to kind of deal with. And we're happy to kind of, you know, build that relationship, because otherwise you can't really, and you have to add a lot of value to their life. I mean, you have to, whether it's a structured supplier, whether it's an unstructured supplier, you have to kind of really do a good job in order for them to pay attention to you. So yeah, I mean, for structured companies, it's been great for us, because we're actually providing them access to an audience that they directly don't serve. So our customers, you won't find them on PandaMart, for example. So our customers were unique. We're providing them a unique set of customers who they can directly advertise to. We do that as well, by the way. So we give away advertising space on our app to partner brands. And we do, you know, interesting kind of campaigns with them as well. So we provide that data, and we provide that, you know, that insight into a customer set that they just don't have at the moment.
So of course, when you first started out, like, you had certain assumptions about consumers, what they wanted, and, you know, of course, the price and the product and all those things. Has that changed over time? Like, has it evolved to you doing certain things differently when it comes to customer, something that's different from when you first started out?
Yes, definitely. I think there have been changes that we've made based on what we've learned over time. I think one thing that we have learned, it was part of the strategy initially as well, but to begin with, we did not very aggressively start with this, but community hubs. And what is a community hub? A community hub is basically a physical retail space that is present in high density, that we would ideally have in high density, high population, relevant areas where our target audience is living in high density. We find a partner ideally an existing customer who's been a loyal customer and wants to kind of deepen that relationship with us. And we find a partner who kind of is a third party. He's not on our particular payroll or is not an employee, you know, not a colleague of ours, but a partner or a franchisee of sorts, where that person is then responsible for bringing on more customers from that particular retail space. The more customers he brings, the more money he makes. And he gets a cut of whatever volume he's able to kind of move for us to these customers that are in and around him. So his responsibility is to kind of build a community and to retain customers onto Dealcart. Now, why did we do this and why has it worked well for us so far? So we've got about six of them in Karachi now. And why it has worked well so far is that in particularly amongst our target audience, even amongst across all socioeconomic segments in Pakistan, the trust in e-commerce is quite low, right? We've all been there where we've ordered something and it turned out to be fake, or we ordered something and it took ages to come, and when it came, it was damaged or something along those lines. So I think to rebuild that trust in e-commerce in Pakistan, we decided to go for these spaces where people have the confidence that this company is present on ground as well. So we can see that in our neighborhood, there's a little, a space where someone from our community is sitting there. So if something goes wrong with a Dealcart order, I can always go and kind of take it up with this person. Even though we provide 24/7 WhatsApp support, and we're quite responsive on that. But just to provide that, to make sure that trust in that community is there, we have these community leaders. I think from there, and the community leaders are also helping adoption. So they're going around and they're helping people understand what Dealcart is, how to group buy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that is something that we've definitely done a little differently from when we started. And I think that's one. And then two, I think another thing that we've done that initially, yes, was always part of the strategy, but was to come later in was advertising partnerships. So I think we've done well there. We've managed to get some great partnerships going with our suppliers. And we initially thought that this would come in later, but it has worked well for us so far.
Have you seen an uptick in customer demand or growth when it comes to, because you know the inflation has been out of control in Pakistan, so has that helped you grow? I mean, at least in terms of, you know, the GMV and all that stuff, has it helped you get more customers, and were you able to keep those customers that came to you as a result of high cost?
So I think yes. I think the macro inflationary environment, we started building in this environment, and based on the kind of pressure that was putting on people, I think it's something that we were always cognizant of, and I think that is working well in our favor from the point of view that more and more customers are now willing to basically down tier on their products. So someone who would buy, let's say, a Dalda or an Ava cooking oil is now, due to that inflation, willing to kind of come down to, let's say, a tier two product, which previously they would not consider, but now it's something that they are considering because it's simply just too expensive. And the fact that because we're a value play and not a convenience play, everyone is now looking for value. So once again, that kind of plays that our positioning in this environment is quite advantageous. And it helps us to kind of grow, to get more customers. And then even in our, you know, when we're communicating to our customers and our potential customers, it's all about price. So yeah, I think from that point of view, the inflation has attracted more customers. And from a retention point of view, I think our retentions are right. I mean, in the e-commerce space are very, very healthy. So yeah, they're in the high, you know, early 60s, our retention numbers. So customers come in, they stick around, they like us. And we, of course, we try to be very, very focused on customer experience as well. Not just the pricing of the products, but also the fact that they get a smooth product experience as well as the delivery experience. So I think that also plays a very important role in retention.
So I know you mentioned, like, you know, since you started out, the inflation has been an issue, at least in the Pakistani economy. How long between the time you started and between the time you raised funding, how long was that?
So I think we were fortunate when it came to fundraising. Right at that time, I think we were at the tail. We were just at the entry point of when we started out in March, we were at the entry point of the financial slowdown and the financial kind of the VC slowdown, the global slowdown that we've seen. The war in Ukraine had started. So things were looking unsteady as we started. At that time, we managed to raise some angel funding that helped us kind of kickstart operations. Actually, we kickstarted our operations from our own money, and then a month or so after that, we started to receive angel funding in our bank. These angels were primarily from Pakistan, Dubai, and the US, previous Sovel network, previous Kareem network, and then some angels that in the US who were very interested to invest in Pakistan at the time. So yeah, those were angel investors that we got roughly in April, and then our VC round happened in July. We closed the VC round in July, essentially. So that was about 3 to 4 months from the time we started into the time when we raised our first VC pre-seed round.
Were there certain milestones that you were trying to hit with the money? Because, you know, you had like very specific amount that you raised, 4.5 million. And was there like a plan in place already where you were like, okay, if we raise this amount of money, this is what we are going to do in the next couple of years? Or were you just being proactive because you just had or anticipated that the market is going to cool down?
Yes, I think it's a bit of both. So we definitely had anticipated that this is going to happen. There were a lot of people who kind of were telling us this, that, you know, you want to ideally raise more than specifically than you need, because you're not sure when this situation is going to improve. And then Pakistan's situation also was worsening with every passing day around that same time, if you recall Q2 and Q3 of 2022. So due to all of that, right, we were told that, you know, raise a bit more than you need. So we did not set out to raise this much. But again, there was a lot of interest in the market at that time. Interest rates were still quite low in the US. So there was a lot of liquidity in the market at that time. So we went over and above what we needed, and we kind of, loaded up on some of the capital. And I think that was a good move on our end, because that's exactly, because we're in a funding winter right now, right? And it's quite brutal when it comes to fundraising. So I think that was one. But then to answer your first question, which was, did you have a plan against this money? Of course, we definitely had a plan. There's generally speaking, a year to 2 years is a decent kind of amount of time to look forward into and then kind of plan when you're an early stage startup, even though all bets are off the second you start and you learn as you go, right? But there's some semblance of planning is very important. So we made like a year, 2 year plan. And the idea is, with this funding, we want to get to unit economics profitability in our first market. And we're not budging from our first market until we get there. Which is Karachi. We're not, and we're close. We're actually quite close. We're quite happy with the way the unit economic story is playing out, and we're very, very focused on it. So the plan is to kind of scale to a level where we have a significant unit economics positive business in 2 years' time in our first market. So we have a business unit that works, right? We have a concept that works. We have a set of customers who love us, and then we go out. We try to scale post that. Essentially, that's the idea for the first 2 years.
One conversation that I'm having with a lot of different founders now that have had raised money, at least in 2021 and 2022, early 2022, is that US dollar was around like 220, 230 at the time, and now it's like, you know, of course it scaled back a little bit, but it's depreciated quite significantly over the past 1 year, a little more than 1 year. So how do you, like, you know, I could ask you what advice you would give yourself or even other people if they're trying to raise money right now? What advice would you give them in terms of, like, how do you tell someone or how do you convince investors that, you know what, yes, the currency is depreciating, because they invest in US dollars, they want to return in US dollars. And for you to hit certain evaluation metrics, you have to increase your revenue by that certain percentage so that, you know, you can account for the depreciation, right? So how does that conversation go? And like, what advice do you give to people now?
I think it's a few things, right? Firstly, if someone is kind of raising their first round of venture capital funding in today's environment, let's say, I think first recognize the people who are actually interested in Pakistan, right? So the problem is right now is that there are a lot of people who will talk to you, but especially when you're new, you don't, and even with us, when we were new, we didn't understand who is really the right fit and which conversation is actually going somewhere. So I think identifying that, speaking to other founders who are raising, speaking to founders who have already raised money, help identify a core set of venture capital firms that would be interested in Pakistan even at this point in time. I think that's important to kind of focus and not waste your time with people who essentially will not be investing in Pakistan. I think that is a one lesson or that I learned and one piece of advice that I would give people. Two, I think, would be that always talk about the longer term play. Right. So number one, Pakistan has been unstable throughout most of its history. It's not like this is the first time Pakistan has been unstable, right? To be very honest. Yes, the dollar has depreciated more than we would have liked, but it's not like Pakistan has not faced ousted prime ministers before. We hang our prime ministers. I'm not sure. Maybe you can edit that out later, but that's what we do, right? And we've seen coups, we've seen the everything that we can possibly see. So this is quite mild actually when it comes to the political situation. And it's not like, you know, someone else was running the country for the past 70 years, right? We everyone knows what's happening. So it's fairly, you know, I'd say that this is something that you have to take in your stride. It's scary. It's people from outside of the country, even people inside the country will not understand why you want to build a startup at this point in time. But if it's something you have to do, you have to do. Right. And I think that you have to take it in your stride. You have to take the instability of Pakistan in your stride. Do not get bogged down by the news. Please don't watch the news too much. It always kind of gets you down. That's the way it's designed. It's designed to keep you miserable and it's designed to kind of you keep coming back to it. So ignore what the hell is happening everywhere else. Focus on what you have to do. And if you build a good business, if you're building something solid that people actually resonate with, you should be able to find some sort of VC funding out there. Maybe you won't find, maybe you won't be able to raise the kind of money that startups raised in 2020, 2021, even at the start of 2022. And that's fine. That's absolutely okay. The startups that raised at too high valuations and raised too much money are actually not in a good position right now, because now the markets have turned. They're looking for more funding and their valuations are too high. And they have to grow into their valuations to actually not go into a down round. So it's okay to build conservatively today. It's actually the right thing to do to build 100% go aggressive, but build conservatively, conserve cash, focus on positive unit economics, focus on solving the real customer problem. If you are doing these things, there are people out there who will potentially invest in your company. There are local Pakistani VCs, there are international VCs. You know, we've recently closed another international VC despite all of whatever is happening, right? So my, that would be, you know, my second piece of advice that, you know, focus on building something great. And if you're building something great, then you should be able to raise some sort of funding, and it might not be crazy, but just continue to build conservatively, focus on unit economics. That's two. And then three, I think, would be if you have the option to kind of, let's say, build something from scratch, and if you're coming up with your idea, maybe also think about dollarized, you know, income. So maybe building something that is taking advantage of what Pakistan is good at, and then selling to people that are not Pakistani, so have non-Pakistani customers. I know that's super easy to say, and I know that that's in a lot of ways, that's like working backward. So ideally, you want to identify a problem and then solve that problem. But this is kind of like trying to find a problem abroad that you can solve from here. But even that's I think, has been a business model that has worked very well for us historically. And I think even in today's environment, if you go into a VC conversation and you say that, yes, I'm building in Pakistan, but I'm, let's say, building for US and European customers, that gets people's attention, because then you've essentially de-risked the Pakistan dollar issue, essentially. Right. And that is, again, something that's interesting. But again, that is not something that, you know, for us, for example, for our idea, this is not something that's really relevant. Right. We cannot dollarize our income, because we are building for Pakistan, and we're building for the underserved, middle income of Pakistan. So for us, it's not relevant. But for a lot of people that are just starting out, I think this is something that they can consider.
I want to know what you think about the startup ecosystem in general. Like, it could be, what do you think about the talent? What do you think about the investor quality? What do you think about the ideas that are being funded? Like, what is your general consensus about the startup ecosystem?
I think that regarding both founders and VCs in Pakistan, I think so far, a lot of people are trying their best and they've done a great job. We just need a lot more of founders, high quality founders, and a lot more high quality VCs, because we have amazing people here, but again, they're not that many of them, right? That's the problem. So we've got some amazing VC firms that are funding startups here. We need like 50 more of them, essentially. Right. And then we also need 50x the number of high quality entrepreneurs that are working in the space, right? And by high quality, I don't mean you know, ex-founders or, you know, just anyone who's willing to work very, very hard and has the resilience to go after something big and something exciting. I think we need a lot more of that. We're super nascent. We're very, very nascent. And I think one thing that we can do better, not only as a startup community, but just generally as people in Pakistan, is that we can be more supportive of each other. I think people within the startup community are now getting more and more supportive of each other. It wasn't that way before. And I think generally speaking, whenever a startup fails, I think the negativity and the kind of, you know, speculation around the integrity of the people who are working in that company, you know, the fact that they failed is just such, there's so much negativity around that, especially from people who have never even come close to a startup. Have no idea about how the industry actually works, right? How the VC and the startup industry actually works globally, and how failure is something that is quite normal. Yes, we want to definitely learn from our failures. That's how we get better. That's how startup ecosystem improves. But you have to be okay with people failing, and you need to stop making fun of people, and you need to stop accusing people without any evidence, right? So I think that is something that I would love for us to do less of, which is to criticize without any basis, and to, again, not to say we shouldn't learn from mistakes, right? We absolutely should. But the negativity around failure is palpable, and it is I think very unproductive. It's very counterproductive, and if that does not, and that affects the psychology of people as well, right? So now if someone is actually trying something, they will hesitate a lot more than they would have otherwise, because they know that everyone will kind of, you know, come after them, right? And these are people who have no idea what's actually happening. If you notice the people who are actually in these companies and other startup founders are the ones who are really quiet. They're not saying a word. Why? Because they're too busy learning from the actual experience so that they don't repeat it themselves, right? So the log jo kaam kar rahe hote hain, wo kaam karte hain, baaki sare bolte rehte hain. So I think that is something that I would really love to see change in Pakistan's ecosystem.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's something that's definitely a pain point. And, I have also dealt with a lot of that. And trying to just explain to people that VCs are like looking for home runs, basically. And
yes.
Startup success is actually an exception. Startup failure is quite normal. And I think
yes.
People still don't seem to understand that, because, when you think of a business, you think of the typical business, right? Someone puts in money and then loses it. It's like, okay, I told you so, right? It's a lot about I told you so. Maine kaha tha, I knew this would happen. Market aisi thi, waisa tha. Pakistan mein kya karoge? All those things, right? So all the negativity that comes into play when it comes to, seeing startups do something. And I think a lot of people try to compare it to the other markets, where other markets that are a lot more mature. And I think that's, of course, that's a mistake. And for some reason, some people are just very bitter. And I think there's no way, there's nothing you can do about that. But that's part of the thing. But yeah, I know a lot of people are trying their best to make sure that this sort of, psychology and mindset changes, and people can, build better businesses and learn from the failures of, other startups that fail. So thank you so much for being on the Misal podcast. This was lovely. This conversation was great. I learned a lot more than I knew going into this conversation. So thank you. Thank you so much for being on the Misal podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Zaid.
Thanks for listening to the Misal podcast. I hope you enjoyed the podcast and will thank me by writing a review or sharing it on social media. Make sure you follow and subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Thanks again. See you soon.